Thank you, Nick. Well, welcome to everybody here in the hall tonight, and also a big welcome to those watching in on the internet. And just before we start, I would like to again just do our little advertisement for the care group line, because we do have listeners up in the house ready to take your call. So if you feel like calling in for any reason at all, there is somebody waiting on the care line. And I believe that those numbers will be on the bottom of the screen, Nick. I don't know if that's true yet. It is true, yes. So the numbers are there on the bottom of the screen for you to call in. And there is also there a WhatsApp number, so you can call really from anywhere in the world, if you like, right now. And those lines will be opened for another couple of hours, yet they close here at 9 o'clock Western Australian Standard Time. So, tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about conditioning. I've titled the talk Investigating Conditioning and Confabulation. So I don't know if you really would have ever heard of the word confabulation, but it is a word that I've become familiar with through my hypnosis practice, through my hypnotherapy practice, because confabulation is something that we really all do. It may not be really quite obvious, but if you look it up in a psychological context, you'll see that they really talk about it as maybe a mental malady, or a bit of a problem for some people. But it really means that you take something in to your mind, take something in to your being, and then you confabulate a story to make it your own view or idea. And as it says in the definitions of this in the dictionary, it talks about it as being something that's done without, it's not a lie. It's something that people passionately and honestly believe that happens. But I wanted to sort of talk about it tonight because I think it really fits in very well with our own conditioning. And I also want to, if we can, to run this through into the meditation when we start the meditation in around half an hour or so, just so that we can maybe look at and understand this a little bit more. And of course, I'm doing all this in the context of the Buddha's seven factors of enlightenment. I've talked about that quite a little bit here over the times that I've given the talks here at the Buddha Centre, just recently, for those that remember that, you will know that the second factor of enlightenment is investigation. And I think this fits in very well. So the first factor again is mindfulness, and then investigation. What happens when you start investigating, then you start to, the third one is starting to get the energy coming up. And when the energy comes up, then you'll start to get good feelings, joy, rapture, ideas. They're quite subtle feelings. These aren't extreme pleasures, but they're kind of nonetheless subtle pleasures. And then that moves into the fifth factor, which is tranquilization, the way that we can just become so tranquil. And then as we become tranquil, the sixth factor can then work for us, where we go deep into concentration. And then the seventh factor is this, the equanimity that comes from all of that. But the second factor of enlightenment, investigation, is really very important for us when we're kind of looking to understand this practice. It's also very important to understand our human condition, just what it is that we're all involved in here. Because, for me, as I've often said here too, for me it's a great mystery, this life, the idea that we're here on this planet and we're kind of in this sort of spatial arrangement with the moon and then the sun, and we know how important or what a reliance that we have on the sun, and then just there's the solar system that plays its part, and then all of that sort of plays into the wider galaxy that we belong to, and then right out deeper into the universe itself, where you've got clusters of galaxies and galactic clusters and so on, and all of this is there. I mean, it becomes a very mysterious thing for us to contemplate, doesn't it? And I certainly don't really know the meaning of all of that or just why it sort of is that way. But the Buddha advised us when he was sort of looking at all this himself is to really to look inside ourselves. He was never really interested in the external world. As I've mentioned before, he never really went out to investigate things externally. He always managed to stay inside. As he said, he saw everything and learned everything that he did about himself and the human condition just from looking at this fathom long length of body, as he talked about. So just coming inside and looking at it from there. And this is really where this investigation part of this practice is really just so important, because we need to just look in. Now, I'd like to just say before I go too much further into talking about conditioning and confabulation, just the reason why we do look in, and it's always good just to clarify that, especially as I know there's a few new people here tonight that maybe haven't heard talks in this way, and I wanted to just make sure that we were somewhat on the same page. And that is really when we are meditating, we are really looking deeply into the present moment. We're recognising and understanding that this present moment that we live in is really the only reality that there is. So when we think about the past, I mean, all of that is important. You know, we learn from the past. You know, we try not to repeat the bad mistakes that we've made in the past. It's not always possible to do, but that's what we certainly try to do. But we recognise that we can even maybe reconstruct the past in the present for ourselves. But we can know beyond any doubt that whatever we reconstruct from the past will always be different. It will always have its own identity, even if we are reconstructing the same thing. So you can see when you look at that and you start to contemplate that a little bit more, you can start to see that the past is really dead and gone. And it's really something in many ways that is often a problem for us. I mean, sometimes it's important to remember what we've done in the past, but sometimes it is also good to try and let the past go, especially if we're hanging on to the past with some trauma. You know, maybe that we're feeling guilty about something that we've done or something that we've said, and all of these things happening like that, just unresolved problems and traumas from the past can be very, very troublesome for the human condition. You know, they tend to stay there subconsciously. It's really the work of a hypnotherapist, really. Some of the things that people bring along to try and understand is these hidden traumas and trouble that we haven't quite resolved. We've never resolved them at the time that they happen. And indeed, some of these things go back over lifetimes. Some of these traumas and troubles come up even in past lives. So understanding that the past is really no longer real, even though we might be kind of referring to it or hanging on to something from it, we can know that there's no reality there. And it's the same with the future. Well, the same but opposite. The future is really something that's yet to come. We don't really... there's no way really that the future, well, I suppose it affects us, but it affects us to the extent that we are kind of involved into the future. Our mind is kind of racing out to hold on to or grab onto things from the future, more or less in the same way as we do from the past, you know, holding on to the past and the future. But we recognise with this meditation, what we're doing with this meditation is that we're practicing to be in the present moment, to be now, to be right here and now. And we recognise that as being the only reality. This is really the only place that is real, because the future isn't real. It may be, we might have strong ideas about what we want to do or the way that it might turn out for us in the future, but also looking back into the past. But none of those things have reality in the same way that the present moment does. And the Buddha was really all about going inside himself with this meditation. This whole process of meditation that we learn about is all about understanding this present moment, uncovering the present moment, going deeper into it. And so just in starting with that, so that we're all at least on the same page with that, then I'd sort of like to introduce just the idea of the way that we are conditioned, and perhaps even just to look at and try and understand just what it is that makes you the person that you are. Where did all these views and opinions and ideas about yourself come from? You know, and you can go back over your life and remember that, you know, when you first came into this world, you were probably, as a baby, you're probably pretty much, we know that we're pretty much a clean slate. From the Buddha's perspective, we know that there might be past lives sort of lurking around here and there too, but if we just disregard that for the moment and you just go back to the conditioning that you've had in this life, you know, the very first people that get involved with us is usually our parents, and we're conditioned very much by them, by what they're teaching us, and we're looking at them, we're using them as role models all of the time and picking up things, because we know we're so dependent. We are dependent creatures, certainly in those first few years, in just being able to, and we learn how to get their attention. We learn how to get what we want from our parents. We learn how to satisfy ourselves, how to make, how to engage with our parents so that they know what to do for us. And all the time we're learning, and this conditioning is going in, and oftentimes we've got no idea really of just what we're doing with this. We're just conditioned. And then, you know, we move on to kindergarten and then into school, and then our schoolmates become more important to us, and sometimes it's very important to be friends. You want to be friends with people, and you want to sort of fit in. And as you get older, you know, coming more up into the teen years and maybe high schools and secondary schools and then universities, it's usually sometimes quite important to take on things that others are telling us, you know, and all this conditioning is going on, coming into us all of the time. And oftentimes when it comes in a subconscious way, that means that you're not consciously aware of what you're taking in, what you're hearing, what you're deciding to bring in about yourself. It'll just be there. It's just there. And it kind of is there to sort of move and push you around and allow you to live your life in the way that conditioning is there for you. And this is, you know, as we're doing, well, I'll just, you know, continue on just talking about schools, and then, you know, the government has its shot at us, doesn't it? The government it usually has a way, and our culture, the way that our culture is. I know I'm an Australian man, I'm not a woman, but if I was a woman, I'd have the conditioning of a woman and an Australian, so I'm not an American or an English person or an Iraqi or an Iranian, you know, it's... and all of those people all have their own cultures, their own ways of... They've all been inculcated with the conditioning from their cultures and their views and ways of seeing the world. So these things, it becomes very complicated in the end. And, you know, when I look back at the views and opinions that I have, and sometimes I really struggle and wonder why, you know, I do think the way that you do, that I do. And it's sort of especially important these days because it's quite interesting, isn't it, the way that our communities, especially in the last little while since COVID has come along, and probably a certain president of the United States has certainly thrown the cat amongst the pigeons there too, in sort of causing all sorts of different ways of sort of seeing what might be true or might not be true. You know, even introducing the idea of alternative facts and things like this. And I must admit, I mean, I don't really, you know, I'm not sort of qualified to know who's right or wrong with all of that. But you just sort of see all this happening, and it's just quite astounding how people will become quite passionate about what it is that they've taken in, their beliefs and their opinions about things, their views. So investigating all that and understanding it, I mean, and certainly with meditation, I mean, we can come to some grips with the conditioning that we have inside ourselves, especially as we start to make our minds peaceful and we start to settle and relax down, as we'll practice to do in a moment. But as your mind does start to settle and it comes down, and then there's these, you know, things that will just appear. I mean, I remember when I first started meditating, there was some things that I remember that I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, these thoughts were coming up that I'd had 20, 30 years beforehand, and even just unresolved little things that I'd said or done that I was, you know, not so happy about, really. Just stuff that I'd never quite resolved. But nonetheless, as your mind becomes quite still, all of these issues start to be there. And they're there, they become even more pronounced as your mind becomes more still. As the stillness comes into your mind as you're practicing, this conditioning that's there can become quite apparent. And, you know, sometimes I look at it and I think, oh, why would I have ever thought that? Or why would I have, you know, said that to this person? You know, that just totally irrational, really, when I look at it from my perspective now. But then when I look at it from my perspective now, even that is conditioned. I know that, you know, anything that I kind of say, even this, you know, what I'm doing here now, I'm just giving a talk on Buddhism. I mean, I am certainly trying my best to be very clear in my mind about what I'm saying, so that I'm not just being, you know, untruthful to you, or not, you know, I'm trying to represent what I'm saying as something that is coming really from the stillness of my practice. So all of these things, you know, you start to be able to work with them a little bit more, a little bit better as your meditation starts to progress, and, you know, you start to understand what it is to be with the stillness. And once the stillness is there, you know, as I've always said, as you practice to do that, and if you can develop that still mind, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful datum to have inside you, yourself, because it's then you're able to reflect from that stillness. You know, when you're kind of making decisions, or you're kind of living your life in the world, you can live your life with a reflection back to that stillness. And that stillness usually offers you a sense of truthfulness and reality, because that stillness is really coming right from this present moment. You're starting to see the world really more from the reality of the present moment, rather than being lost in some kind of escapade that you've sort of got going on out in the external world about yourself. You're really more in line with what I would call the truth and beauty of the of being closer to the present moment. But then the whole of the Buddhist practice really is sort of taking you deeper and deeper into that, until you can finally get to the point where you see what the Buddha was pointing to, just as when he was pointing to this enlightenment. And just even talking about that, I suppose I can just mention that the three characteristics of all things that he talked about in some of the lists that he made to illustrate some of the points that he was making, but there's the three characteristics of things, of all things, as I think most people will know, that any if you've sort of been around Buddhism for a little while anyway, is that the first one is that everything is dukkha, this sense of unsatisfactoriness. And this is really, this dukkha really comes about because of this troubled nature of conditioning, the way that this conditioning is always formed from the dual nature of the way that the universe exists, from the in understanding that you can never really hold on to one thing without its opposite sort of arising or causing some kind of tension with whatever you're holding, you know. So if you want to think about light, you know, you've automatically brought into your mind darkness. If you want to think about goodness, then there's badness, and so it goes on. Every little part of our language is sort of set up like that. Every little part of our psychology is set up like that. You follow what Jung and some of the psychologists talk about. There is always, for whatever condition we've got going on in our mind, there's always the shadow side to it, as Jung talks about. And that's really, really where the treatment for some of our problems comes from, you know, being able to balance the world the way it is. But even as I've said often enough here too, just even in the physical universe itself, all of that also has a dual nature. It's all matter and antimatter. When physicists look at this world and they try to work out a unification theory for it, they've always got in mind the fact that there's everything out there is balanced. You know, if you've got electrons buzzing around an atom out there, you've also got positrons buzzing around an antimatter atom. So, you know, with its protons and antiprotons and its neutrons and antineutrons, all of these things, all of the whole world has this dual nature. So, you know, you start to get the idea that when you do, or you are sort of out grasping on or holding on to some sort of idea, some sort of something physical even, you are automatically, you know, you, if you're going to understand it properly, you've got to automatically see what the opposing part of that situation is, because it will always be there in one way or the other. And this is really when the Buddha was talking about dukkha, I'm sure that he had something like this in his mind, because he was just saying that dukkha is just ubiquitous in the world. It's something that we can work with and understand dukkha. We try to make our lives as happy and as peaceful as we can. But the Buddha did say that the world is, this is its nature, the nature of the world is this dukkha, this unsatisfactoriness, this dis-ease. You could say, you know, disease or dis-ease. The, you know, just the way that it's so difficult to make anything permanent. So that brings us on then to the second characteristic of all things, and that is that everything has this nature. He talked about it in his terms, his Pali terms, as anicca, but that anicca just means impermanent. So everything in the world is impermanent. It's shot through with dukkha, but it's also impermanent. So nothing can ever last forever. So you can't really make a permanent structure out of anything. I had some TAFE teachers here during the week that came just to hear a little bit about Buddhism, and I was telling them about a student that I remember. I remember going to a primary school. It was a really a lovely school. Well, most of these schools, it was great, teaching children. But anyway, they're only young children, just in a grade six, you know, just the senior school in the junior, in the lowest school. But I was sort of just talking a little bit about this this idea that everything is impermanent. And I'd said to the kids, you know, can anyone in the class think of anything that's permanent in the world? And I had this one little chap put his hand up and he says, the laws of impermanence are permanent. So I couldn't really argue with that at all. It was a very clever answer. But nonetheless, that is really something that we can always look at for ourselves. We can investigate, another part of the investigation, just to look and see, is that true? What the Buddha was talking about there, this idea of impermanence. Is that really true? Is everything impermanent? And I think, you know, I've sort of tried to take that on over the years too, and I think that the truth of it is that it really is that way. But then the third characteristic of all things that he talked about is that everything is anatta. Anatta really just means no self. So the Buddha talked about there being no self at the heart of this. There's no Dennis. I mean, apparently there's a Dennis, but really when you go deep into the and start to investigate into the heart of the present moment to find Dennis, you know, there's you find that he's not there. It's a wonderful story that Ajahn Brahm told some years ago. He was talking about this dream that he had, and he was on this bus, and he was travelling, you know, bouncing around in the bus, and everything was lovely. He was looking at all these lovely scenery and trees and everything. But then all of a sudden, the bus went boom, boom, and it bounced down, and it was just terrible. There was all these potholes, and the terrain was terrible, you know, and he was yelling out, get back to the good stuff, you know. And then boom, he'd be back to the good stuff. And so this went on for quite a while, you know, and he was then back through this stuff that was causing him to grizzle at the bus driver, and standing up, and he said, get back to the other side, get back to the where I want to be. And anyway, after a little while, he got really, in his dream, he got really quite cranky with this bus driver. And he said, I'm going to get up and go on down and give that bus driver a piece of my mind. So he gets up out of his seat and he walks down and he's kind of bouncing around the passageway as he gets down towards the driver. And then as he kind of holds onto the post and looks in at the driver's seat, do you know who was there? Of course, it was no one. No one was there at all. So he called that little story, The Driverless Bus. And I think it's a wonderful analogy, really, of just this no self arrangement that we have. I mean, we do think that we're kind of in charge and in control of everything, but in actual fact, when we kind of really look, there really isn't. There isn't anyone in the driver's seat anyway. There's just a flow of conditions and this conditioning that we kind of believe in. But just moving from that conditioning. We'll finish off in a minute and just do some meditation too, but just moving along a little bit from that conditioning and just seeing, and what I'd invite you to do is when you're looking and doing this investigation into your own, especially after you've done some meditation, your mind's quite still, you know, this is a good time to contemplate these things and to look into these things, to investigate into what the what this human condition is showing us, just to try and understand some of the mysteries that are here with us. But and you do start to see, I mean, how this confabulation of these conditions that come into us one way or the other. And I was just to give you just a bit of an idea of the way that I sort of see this with in my practice, because very often, you know, I'm trying to help people by adjusting the tapes, if you like, that are there inside someone's subconscious mind. And of course, you're always trying to do this ethically and right, and certainly with the client's approval of whatever we're doing, because it's, you know, you find that this is can be quite powerful thing to do. Just so the idea is really what, you know, the way that a hypnotist works really like this is really to first of all, you either talk to the person in a boring kind of a way so that they end up just sort of taking no notice so that the conscious mind just sort of drifts off. Or you might use a method of confusing someone. So that's why the method I usually like to use is kind of just reading from a script that's really quite confusing, that the person doesn't really know what you're talking about in the end and the conscious mind just sort of drifts away. Or you can shock them. You know, shock is really another way of kind of just allowing the or removing the conscious mind from the process. But once someone is kind of, you know, dreaming or they're off somewhere else, the conscious mind is off and they're not really guarding what's in their mind, you know, that's when you can start putting a suggestion in. You put a suggestion into their mind and then when the conscious mind comes back again, the conscious mind just kind of takes that suggestion to be, well, you know, I've always had that suggestion. And this is where the confabulation usually starts. You can, you know, and very often I'll kind of give, always the best and good suggestions, hopefully, that I give, especially around Dharma and things like that. But, you know, very often I'll sort of give a suggestion to someone and then if they come back in a session later on and I'm maybe listening to them, you know, they'll be sort of speaking about that suggestion as if it's their own. You know, I've always thought that way. But there's this way of confabulating what it is that is now in their subconscious mind, and it's kind of there and it's protected by their conscious mind as well. The conscious mind does it. And you can see how all of this works, you know, even from a child, you know, when a child's mind is quite guileless and quite, you know, open, you can sort of tell a child anything, can't you? And it's because it's not experienced, the child. So, you know, that's why parents, when they're looking after their children, you know, the child wanders towards a fire, you pull them back, no, that's too hot, that's dangerous, don't go there. So gradually, you know, subconsciously, this goes into the child and they know that that's hot, you know, that's hot. Whereas, you know, you could, you know, maybe if that wasn't the case, they could end up with severe burns or things like that. So parents are always guiding their children, looking after them, making sure they're safe and sort of putting this conditioning in the different ways. I'm sure that you probably remember yourself, your mum and dad's ways of speaking to you and saying things about how to be safe. So, but gradually as the child grows up and starts to develop an identity, a consciousness of their own, well then all of these things just become locked in. They're confabulated into that person. I'm using that word in a specific way there to we're trying to extend the meaning of it just to, you know, to illustrate the way that I see this kind of working, how it works inside myself, but also how it might work in you if you think about this too. Just, you know, I remember seeing a stage hypnotist once telling someone, you know, just using his skills and telling someone to do something or to say something about a particular thing. And, you know, inevitably, you know, that person, when asked, if you ask the person, you know, why did you do or say that? Oh, that's how I always work. I always think like that. There's never usually the idea, oh, you know, Joe Bloggs just conditioned that into me, or someone else just said that, and it's in, you know. I often think of the example of sitting in the front of the television, and you're very relaxed. You're kind of quite you know, in a relaxed, probably in a, you maybe concentrated, maybe you're watching a film or something like that, and you're focused, and then all of a sudden the film stops and there's an ad comes on, you know, and it's maybe Kellogg's cornflakes are the best, you know, they're good for you. You should buy Kellogg's cornflakes. And then, boom, the film comes back and you kind of don't even remember really that that ad's gone in. You know, you don't sort of discriminate it at all, but it's gone in. And all these advertisers, they know this because the next time you're at the supermarket, you're walking down the shelf and there's Kellogg's cornflakes. Oh, you know, I like Kellogg's cornflakes. I've always liked those. They're healthy. So all of these techniques, I suppose you could call them, are employed by all sorts of sales people to condition us and to make us, or to push us around, really, in ways that we don't really even. I mean, this is the stuff of the world, isn't it? It's not. This is where I'm really just describing here just the natural way that we as involved in this human condition, live our lives, really. So, just with those few words, in being able to learn about the conditioning and the confabulation and investigating that into us. But also, I suppose the other thing that's important to say just about the three characteristics of all things that I just wanted to mention about that again is that those three characteristics, if you kind of really contemplate them and look at them, eventually they'll give you the idea or the impulse to start to question this world, to question this external world in the way that the Buddha did. Because the Buddha, as I mentioned, when he was investigating things, he never went outside, he never went external. He always went internal. He went inside himself to investigate these things. Because, you know, eventually as he says, this world is mind-made. So when you're thinking about these three characteristics of all things, it is a very, very useful thing to remember that in what the Buddha said, just to question what it is that we're looking at out here. Where is this world? Where is this universe? Is it out there, really? Apparently it is. You know, I'm certainly not going to argue with that. Apparently it is out there. But what's the reality? What's the reality of that statement? And it's really only when you go deep inside and you start to understand your mind and start to understand this conditioning process that all of these, the clarity of what we can see in our minds starts to become apparent. And we can start to really see things in a different way. Maybe starting to understand that maybe the paradigm that we're looking at here is the world is out there. Maybe that's not true. Maybe a shift in paradigm will kind of bring the universe inside. And that's certainly the way that it feels to me. And even in this next little part in the meditation, when we start this now, I'd like to sort of introduce that to you a little bit more again too, just in the way that we can ground ourselves into this earth, because we are part of this earth, but equally we're part of this universe. And as I'll hope to maybe just do in this little meditation practice, we can perhaps start to get a feel for maybe when we're sitting here on our mats or on our seats, that we are actually sitting here with the whole of the world and the whole of the universe sitting here with us, sitting inside us indeed. Whereabouts is this universe? So these are questions for us all to investigate. And that second part of looking at the factors of enlightenment is really a very important one. So, if everyone would like to make themselves comfortable, right hand on the left with your thumbs just gently touching, back nice and straight, energy nice. Just starting to breathe through your nose, closing your mouth, and just allowing the tongue to find its place. It usually just likes to rest against the palate of your mouth, just the roof of your mouth. Just let it rest there, and then you can just breathe in through the nose. And just as we're starting this practice, we'll just start by just becoming mindful of the body. So you can just start by, I always like you could just give your toes a little wiggle and feel them. It's always good to feel, because mindfulness of the body is the first foundation of mindfulness, and the second one is always feeling. Mindfulness of feeling. Feelings are really very important to try and experience. So just feeling your toes, perhaps against the texture of your socks or the floor, and then just moving the attention across the arch of your foot and into your heels, then up into your ankles and calves, shins, and then moving up through the knees and the thighs, and just where there's any tension at all, just allow it all to relax. Just let all the tensions relax. And when you get a bit more time too, if you're sitting at home, just it's always good to just spend a little bit more time that I'm allowing for this process, just to looking inside your legs, inside your toes and feet, just feeling the hardness of your shins and the softness of your calf muscles and the strength of your thighs. And then moving through to your bottom and just feeling how that's got a certain pressure where it's seated. Then up through the lower back and the tummy. And then moving up into the upper back around the shoulder blades and the chest. And again, right through the trunk of the body, there's always the opportunity there to feel right into your chest, to feel the rhythms that are in there, the little rushes and the movements, the gurgles. And at all times here, it's really good just to feel some appreciation for your body too. Just the way that this body, I often contemplate for myself, this heart has been beating now for 72 years. Been bringing life to me, giving me the chance to self-reflect, to understand. You can really feel grateful. Then feeling from the shoulder blades down through the arms and your elbows into your forearms and wrists and hands and fingers. And round the fingers, just as you're just holding them lightly together, just see if you can notice the tingling that's there in your fingers, where all the nerve endings finish on the surface of your fingers. And I sometimes use that as a catalyst to to feel and understand what that effervescent feeling, that tingling feels like. And then to sometimes look for that same sensation somewhere else, maybe on your knees or on your legs somewhere. And you notice that that tingling is really all over. And sometimes you can really get into that and it feels like your whole body is just like a bundle of energy, a ball of energy. And all this is really indicating to you that you're starting to relax. Your body's relaxing. And it becomes light. And the energy is starting to balance. And your back kind of naturally straightens. And you might want to also invoke a little idea of joy, just maybe even bringing that smile to your face. And then feeling in behind the smile, just how that affects the internal parts of your body. And moving up into the head. And the neck. Behind your eyes. Your tongue and your mouth. And then when you're ready, just to find a place. Probably around the tip of your nose is good, and just start to notice the breath as it flows in and it flows out. Just beginning and ending. And hopefully you're starting to feel now as you're just watching your breath, just making that the only thing that's there in your mind, just this experience of your breath flowing in and flowing out. Body nicely relaxed. And your mind is also relaxing. You're listening to the words that I'm saying, but there's no need to think about them or try and make any commentary around the words that I'm saying. You don't need to worry about their meaning. Just let them wash over the top of you and just stay with the breath. And hopefully, too, you're also starting to notice now that the mind behind the breath is really quite still. There's no thoughts going on. It's just a focus on the breath as it's flowing in and it's flowing out. And you can start to get an idea of just how the mind can be quite content with just this much. The mind's not moving out to try and grasp onto any desires. Or it's not trying to push away anything it doesn't want. So the first two hindrances are starting to abate, and the mind is just developing a nice contentment. Just being content with this much. A beautiful breath. Life-giving breath. And you can also notice how the body is not restless. It's not trying to move around. But equally, it's not dropping off to sleep or tired. It's awake and it's aware. Because the third and the fourth hindrance of restlessness and sloth and torpor are coming into balance. So this contentment that's there because the usual way that the mind is running out to grab things and to push things away, trying to manipulate desires and aversions, that has for the moment abated. And we just know that contentment that's there. Just with the breath. We can also see that the body's energy is coming into balance. And it feels quite beautiful. There's quite a subtle pleasure in just sitting with the mind in this way. And the fifth hindrance of doubts is not there because the mind's quite content and balanced. We don't need to think up any problems or doubts. And you're starting to notice as this joy, this subtle joy and pleasure is there, how it does start to tranquilize the body, how the body feels so calm. And then as you're putting a little bit more effort into the looking at just the breath, just concentrating a little more, you can see how the concentration easily falls onto the breath. To notice it flowing in and then flowing out. And can you see how the mind is really quite clear, quite precise? As the concentration and the relaxation comes into the mind, that ability to see clearly becomes very apparent. And then hopefully you're starting to get a sense of the stillness that's behind the breath as it's flowing in and out. Noticing that each in-breath flows in from still, from the stillness that's there, from the consciousness of stillness. The breath begins, comes in, moves to its fulfillment, and then it reverses and starts to flow out. And it's flowing back out into the stillness. Beginning and ending in the still consciousness of your mind. Breath itself is full of consciousness, flowing in and flowing out. So if you can, it's always useful to try and just note the experience of that stillness. What does it feel like? Is it possible to bring that stillness back into this room at the end of the meditation? Because in a moment I'm going to ring the bell to signal the end of the meditation. But over the three resonances of the ringing, I'd invite you just to do a little stock take, just to notice where you are now compared to when we started. But also to see if you can bring that stillness back into the room. And be aware of it when your eyes open. Just to see whether or not you're able to see the consciousness of seeing. Or indeed the consciousness of all of the five senses. All there inside the stillness of this mind, the still consciousness of mind. the way that the stillness is creating the breath. Creating all the conditions. Well, hopefully you're able to use that meditation in, I guess, the spirit of the night, just in the way of using the meditation to investigate, to look deeper into this human condition. And hopefully hopefully are able to bring back that stillness, bring back the still consciousness into this room. And cultivate it, amplify it. Practice to use it in your everyday life. Practice to be mindful of it. And it's always a very, very useful thing to have there, to have the still consciousness here as a datum point, a datum point for you to reflect from, because you can always be very confident that if you're reflecting from that stillness, you're very close to the present moment. You're very close to truth. And you're also always able to appreciate the beauty that comes with being with that truth. Because truth and beauty are really a pair. That's really the why I think that in all of the lists that the Buddha made, you know, and even sort of bringing in the fourth factor of enlightenment, just pointing to the fact of the rapture and the joy, the subtle pleasures that it's there. This is certainly not a pleasure it's not an extreme pleasure. This is a pleasure that's really quite subtle as your mind comes into balance. It's not in an extreme, it's starting to move to a balance, but that's, the Buddha always pointed to these joys and the pleasure that we can have. It's almost like it's almost compelling in a way to just want to be with the stillness, with this presence, to be with the truth. So, having said those few words, I would just like to remind especially the people that are looking, that the telephone lines at the care group, the care house, are still open, and they will be open until 9 o'clock on Western Australian Standard Time. So you're very welcome to call there. To call, doesn't matter which part of the world you're from, you can call for just, well, hopefully it's just, I think it is, just the price of a local phone call these days. Really wonderful technology that is available now. But you can call really from anywhere in Perth or anywhere in Australia, and there'll be someone there to take your call. But for the rest of us, I'd very much like to invite you all to come over to the kitchen with us, and we've got some food there. Ron is here. It's always nice to see Ron here because he always brings a few little tasty morsels along for us to enjoy, and we can have a cup of tea together and maybe continue the discussion over there. Over in the kitchen. I'd certainly very much like to get to know you all and hopefully meet each other, and we'll have a good time. So thank you for your patient listening, and good night to everybody.